Day 8 of the 2022 Men's World Cup in the books, and it's a day of second lives. Starting with Costa Rica, Los Ticos, a 1-0 win over Japan and giving themselves a shot to make it out of the group.
Samesies for Germany, who found a late equalizer and a point against Spain, teeing up a tasty last match day for Group E.
Tasty, like a tagine. That's Bobby's line. Bobby literally wrote that line and expected me to say it. And like Morocco's football today, they beat Belgium 2-0, setting up a last set of matches with three teams who can win the group.
I'm pretty sure tagine is your favorite food, Doyle, like the Netherlands are my favorite team. But back to that fourth squad in Group F, Canada. They came out flying and took a 1-0 lead over Croatia, their first men's World Cup goal ever. But Luka Modric and his friends dominated the second half to cruise to a 4-1 win, eliminating the Canadians from contention.
Welcome, everybody, to Club and Country. And, of course, welcome to everyone listening on the Extra Time feed as well. This is MLS's official daily World Cup show. Every day, 5 p.m. Eastern Time on Twitter Spaces and, of course, on Club and Country Today under the MLS Today feed on Spotify and wherever you get your podcasts. I am David Goss. Along with me today, I've got Bobby Warshaw, I've got Matt Doyle, and I've got Andrew Weavey. Weavey will remain on mute through the entire show while he parents, but in spirit, he is super dedicated to this show, and he is here. For all of you listening on the Extra Time feed, we will have a normal Extra Time episode coming out tomorrow where we might talk about Messi, but probably not. For anyone listening on the podcast, we've got a special interview coming up midway through this show. We've got a reporter from the New York Times who is on the ground in Qatar, in Allison McCann, of course, a former Stanford women's soccer legend herself, to talk about everything going on in the country, the experience at the games, and much more. She sat down with Bobby. So if you're listening on Twitter Spaces, you're going to have to go find the podcast feed when it comes out in a little bit. And if you're on the podcast feed right now, welcome. Leave a review.
Yeah, what's up? How you doing?
Super nice. Yeah. Be like really complimentary to us. If you have missed any of our shows, we're going to dig in deep on Canada right now. I know it's been an emotional day for a lot of fans. I watched the game alongside former Canadian women's national team captain Amy Walsh and Pa Modoka and Susanna Collins. And I bled and cried and felt sick with all of you. So we're going to talk about everything Canada in this show. We'll break down all the other big games from today, the big upsets, and of course, Germany versus Spain, and then we'll help you preview tomorrow's action. But our favorite part of the show, what we do every single episode to open things up, is our Free for Life category. Who has etched themselves into national lore and history in their country? We take nominees, so if you ever see anything or feel anything, tweet it at us throughout the day, and I open the floor now to you two for nominees from today.
I'll take the first nominee, because this one is really, really important to me. And it goes to Costa Rica's Keisher Fuller and his mishit for the goal. He was so in flow today that he could knuckleball it into the top corner, confusing the defenders, confusing the goalkeeper. It wasn't just a wonder goal. It was a wonder mishit. And Keisher Fuller, for me, I think should get free for life in Costa Rica for the rest of time.
I literally mocked Costa Rica on this show by saying, coming out of the Spain game, maybe you shouldn't start Keisher Fuller at winger. Maybe that will be enough to help you. The guy is a fullback that their coach loves to put at the wing to be quote-unquote more defensive. It was a train wreck against Spain. And the only shot on goal in two games for Costa Rica is this knuckleball thing that Keisher Fuller hits in this game, pretty much just trying to bail out of the moment and run back up the field. And the Japanese goalkeeper overdives. The ball is hit so poorly. This is like little giants type stuff. And yeah, Keisher Fuller is not going to be able to walk down the street in Costa Rica for a really long time because, as you said, the moment alone will stand the test of time.
So I got to wait. No, I mean, they're back into it. Yes. All right. They control their own fate. If they beat Germany, then they're through. I think they, you know, probably aren't going to. But here's the thing. Isn't Costa Rica a big enough soccer country at this point in their history where just scoring a game-winning goal, I don't care if it's their first win since 2014, just scoring a game-winning goal doesn't get a guy free for life?
No. So yes and no. The no is the sport is so massive. Mm-hmm. that if you do one thing for the national team, it is free for life, because that's the only thing that matters, right? The guy who stole second base for the Red Sox and then they came back in that game, that dude, I think it's Dave Roberts, that dude's a legend, and he did nothing else because the Red Sox mean so much, right? That is the Costa Rican men's national team in soccer. Like, when I went down there this year, there is a channel showing a Costa Rican former international game 24/7. Just showing games on loop. That's how big this team is. So because of the magnitude and the focus on this one team, that moment alone is enough to elevate you into that spot. Does that feel a little better to you?
It does, but it still feels weird to me, because this is a Costa Rica team. What they went to the quarterfinals in 2014. They're always one of the three, or I guess four now, best teams in CONCACAF. They've had other, you know, trips to the World Cup where they've gotten out of the group. Like, this is a team that is not unaccustomed to winning at this level.
But all of the people who were on those teams and did things are legends.
Okay.
Like, they stand alone. Like, they get celebrated when they come back to the stadium.
They're
right?
All a hell of a lot better than Keisha Fuller, too.
That I would 100% agree with you on. 100%. And to be clear, the Costa Rica's gotten out of the group stage one time. Other than 2014, 1990. Okay. No, they did well in 2002, but they didn't get out. I think they got 3 points and tied for second and did not get out.
Right.
And anytime Andy Heron plays for your team, you know it's legendary. Okay, so Bobby gave us a nominee. Doyle, do you have anything else? Do I need to push?
I'm just here to push. I'm the devil's advocate. I'm here to push back on all these nominees.
Then I look forward to our next one, because our next one is John Herdman, the men's national team coach for Canada.
All right, and we're going to get into this in greater detail. I will say that John Herdman blew it today.
Uh-huh.
But John Herdman also deserves free for life for everything that Canada accomplished this cycle.
All of that is true, but that's not why. Every single Canadian will know John Herdman's name because they saw a picture of a fake John Herdman naked with a maple leaf over his junk in Croatian. Like, there is zero chance that that's not the lasting memory and the breaking out into the cultural norm of this moment, of this World Cup for Canada, right? Like, everyone who doesn't like soccer and doesn't care, when you bring up that team now for the next year or two, they're gonna be like, oh, they have that coach who said the thing about Croatia, and then they put up that picture, right? Like, that's the type of thing that breaks you out and makes you mainstream. And I believe that that's what John Herdman has brought, and that's what John Herdman will get coming out of this World Cup.
So he's main get free.
I don't think so, but it's also Canada, so a lot of stuff subsidized anyway. It's like, not that hard.
Not Tim Hortons. Tim Hortons isn't subsidized, David. Come on now.
And my final one is Munir Mohammed, by the way, Mohammedi. He was the goalkeeper for Morocco today. He was not on the team sheet when the first best or the starting 11 came out. An injury occurred between then and the start of the game. Most broadcasters didn't know he wasn't on the field. He was on the field for the first 15 minutes. And I told Bobby this last week or 2 weeks ago when we previewed the World Cup. One of my favorite World Cup moments ever was when Shaka Hislop was forced into the lineup against England because of an injury in warmups for Trinidad and Tobago, and then played like the game of his life. And so I love when this happens. And Morocco shut out Belgium and got a win. So I've got three nominees today. And you guys are sitting on your hands with a lot of nothing. So I'm just throwing that out there. I feel like Canada coming out the gates strong, not going to worry about the next 89 minutes. I'm just going to focus on what I've accomplished so far. Let's take that as an opportunity to dig into Group F. Croatia sitting in first place, 4 points, plus 3 goal differential. Morocco in second place on 4 points as well, plus 2 goal differential. Belgium in third place on 3 points and minus 1 goal differential. And then Canada, 0 points, minus 4 goal differential. That officially eliminates them from the potential of getting out of the group here at the 2022 World Cup. But Alfonso Davies, in the second minute, the fastest goal of this World Cup, and it's the first goal in Canadian men's national team history at the World Cup level in their second ever appearance after waiting 36 years. Bobby, Canada going home, but still a lot that there's excitement about amongst Canada fans.
Yeah, if you are around this Canadian men's soccer team, if you are in Canada who follows this team, you have to feel really good and proud about what you saw in these two games. Because I think to put into context, if you live around the world and you did not know much or anything about this Canadian men's soccer team, you do now. And that impression, that thing you know, is positive. You have to be impressed with the way they approach these games, the technical ability, the mindset around it. And I am always cautious about making broad statements about turning a corner or about finally getting to a new milestone. But it feels like a safe statement to say that this Canadian men's soccer program has turned a corner and they are only going upward and they are now in the legitimate conversation about soccer teams in that tier around the world. And that is a huge accomplishment for what they have achieved in the last few years. And the fact that really what I think is the poster boy, the catalyst for this progression the last 2 years, Alphonso Davies, was the first player, the first men's player to ever score in a World Cup for Canada, is also fitting that he gets that honor and that memory moving forward.
Yeah, I can't disagree with most of what you said. And throughout this day, I've gone back to what did we all say 2 weeks ago and a month ago and 2 months ago when the draw happened about what Canada had to accomplish and what the goals were. And I think most people said, prove you belong on the world stage, prove to yourself, and then prove it to the rest of the world and try and break this team out, as I said, of your niche into mainstream Canadian culture. And the way they performed against Belgium, obviously the viewership numbers that we're hearing already out of that game and what we expect on now a weekend game rather than a weekday game for this team, I think the respect you heard from Kevin De Bruyne and Tata Martino and Roberto Martinez and all these people around the world now seeing this team pretty heavily, as well as the experience these players will take in that they belong here, that's all mission accomplished. So there's a lot that Canada has to be proud of, has to be excited about. And that's a lot of what we heard coming out of the first game was pride. Yeah, it'll be a little more muddled, I think, right now coming out of the second game because of the scoreline, because of the way some of it went, but I think people will come back around to that and they still have an opportunity to make it even cleaner. If they go and win against Morocco and put up their first ever win, they could still come out of this, I think, even more positive than where they stand. And we'll talk more about that later. But you mentioned Alphonso Davies. I think you have a lot of players. Davies is an interesting one because he is the face of things. I think for everyone else who there was question marks of, could they function at this level? They've had self-belief and proof, right? Alistair Johnson, we're hearing the rumors. Tejan Buchanan already going to Europe, even more rumors now. Kamal Miller. So many of these players that don't have experience playing at the highest level, they got their World Cup experience. They got to play and show that they can compete at this level. And Doyle, to me, the biggest thing from the way we see things, or at least what I get to see from behind the scenes a little bit more, is this is not a golden generation or a fluke or a one-off. Canadian soccer has changed. And I think this team is just a sign of that changing time.
So I mostly agree with that. I'm going to add the caveat at the front. It is a little bit of a golden generation when you have Jonathan David, Alphonso Davies, and Tejan Buchanan all within like the same, 18 months you get these guys. You can't count on that. No matter how good a conveyor belt of talent you have, especially with a talent like Davies, you could have a 100 years of history and not have a player as good as Alphonso Davies. So there is an element of a golden generation, but what is really, really important and what really has helped turn the corner, in Bobby's words, look, 15 years ago, the USSDA was instituted. That actually coincided with Toronto FC becoming a professional franchise, coming into MLS. And a couple of years after that, Montreal came in and Vancouver came in. And if you look at the vast majority of this national team, these are guys who have either come through academies, come through the USSDA, come through MLS to one degree or another. And then you look, down the road to Canada's U23s and their U20s and U17s, and you're seeing guys who have that background. And it's the same thing as what we've seen with the U.S., where the vast majority of this group of U.S. players, these are guys who have had high-level training. And that didn't used to exist in Canada. And the Canadians that we speak to, the experts, whether it's former players like Patrice Bernier or Josh Cloke, the great writer for The Athletic, guys who live and breathe this stuff, they say, like, this is just night and day from 20 years ago. Like, Atiba Hutchinson played today. He probably shouldn't have, but he played today. The team that he started his professional career with folded 20 years ago. Like, that doesn't happen anymore for Canada. You know, that this is now a soccer country where players like Richie Larea had three years with Orlando City and then got cut. And if Toronto FC didn't exist, like, he would have been retired at 25, or he would have been unattached FC.
And that just,
it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen like that for Canada anymore. There's a pathway. So while this top end is just, it's inexplicable how they ended up with Tejan, David, and Davies all at once. Like, it's such a great dice roll. It's such, like, such good luck on all that at once. Like, what's really important is that the rest of it is sustainable. There are going to be more Ishmael Kones. There's a Jaden Nelson or a Jaquiel Marshall-Ruddy coming through in Toronto. There's hopefully a Matteo Campagna coming through in Vancouver. Like, this works. They're doing the things that great, you know, soccer nations around the world, they're doing that now in Canada. And when you have that level of talent and you have that level of know-how, the talent, it doesn't just dry up. More of it comes through. And now the next challenge for Canada, whoever's in charge, be it John Herdman for four more years or if they go in a different direction, is to make sure that you can be clear-eyed and ruthless when you need to be about integrating the next generation of these kids. That's a struggle. We've seen the U.S. struggle with that over the last 20 years, none more so than in 2018. But it's something that they're going to have to do, because it's like Ishmael Kone is not going to be the last surprise who comes through in the 2020s. Like, there is going to be some other 19-year-old kid who suddenly gets on the field from one of these teams, and you're like, oh man, we got to get him into the national team setup as quickly as possible. And this is the exact problem that Canadian men's soccer has never, ever had. Mm-hmm. They've never had this because they've never had that conveyor belt of talent. It's here now. It's a disappointing day, but there's so much to be optimistic about for the next 4 years and beyond.
And I said I watched the game with Amy Walsh and Pamo Doka, who coached in CPL, which, again, okay, it's not going to produce national team players left and right, but even you think of a player like Michael Baldissimo, who may never make it, but right now, he's not out of a professional scene. He's going to go into the CPL and play at that level because there's even more opportunity for players to stick around. You look at D-Rose kids, what they were able to do. His son was able to do for York and now maybe move himself back into a higher level, whether it's MLS or outside. There's just more chances for players to stick and learn and get their careers, as well as coaches. And that's the other part of opening up the system and extending it, is having more intelligent, more well-prepared coaches that can help players reach their highest level. I mean, Jonathan David still, you know, he had his youth coach that helped bring him to Europe because he was fully committed to the way his coach worked. And Bobby Smyrdiotis has half a World Cup roster and the guy's never coached in a first division in his life. And that's how important the youth coaches can be. And especially in a country like Canada, where you don't have a massive population to pull from. I'd also say when you talk about this team, like, as special as the three guys you named are, there's been special players in Canadian history. To me, it's the depth and to be able to fill out a roster and compete behind those players and not just say, D-Row, win us a game. And if you don't, and you and Julian De Guzman can't win us a game, we're going to lose. Now there's structure and base to that, to this team. And there are other guys who can elevate themselves for moments, like a Richie Larea, like a Sam Adekube, who we saw against the U.S. and we saw against Mexico. Like a Kyle Larin, like Alistair Johnson, like Kamal Miller, that the team that they have built is what's new for Canada. And that depth of professional players is what's really special. Bobby, let's talk about the game here. Because 4-1, so it wasn't exactly what you wanted. They start with the goal. What did you see from Canada here in game two?
We saw the pros and cons of the concept of bravery. for the most part, when teams have gone out and tried to press and tried to play and had real intent to what they're doing, we've applauded it. And we've said, good for you for being brave. Good for you for demonstrating what you're capable of. And for the most part, it's worked out. And this was the opposite of that. This was a team and a coach that said, once again, we want to press. Once again, we're okay stretching ourselves. We're okay going numbers down or 1v1 certain situations. And for the first 10 minutes, it looked like it was going to work again, right? It worked for 90 minutes against Belgium. It worked for the first 10 minutes against Croatia. And then we saw the flip side. And then we saw why every country who is an underdog doesn't try and press and play at the World Cup. And Canada just got exposed. Right? Croatia is really good. Croatia is coming back from making the final of 2018. And the two things I want to hone into, right? Because we can use this word bravery. We can talk about the concept of real positive intent. But the two ways that I thought it manifested itself were defending high, right? Not drawing your line of confrontation at midfield, but stepping both your forwards and your defensive lines higher. And then really trying to get an extra attacker on the field, putting Kyle Larin into the lineup, defending in what looked to me like a 4-4-2 defensive block where you take out the third center back and you add an extra attacker, which may or may not have been for shape as much for talent, but it showed a real positive intent from John Herdman. And that, along with the high defending, really just punished them in the end because Croatia is a really good team.
Yeah, it verged at one point from bravery to Russian roulette, because what got Canada here was being brave in those transition moments and then dropping into a block and being so difficult to break down. We saw it all throughout qualifying. We talked about this on the show, I think last night, when we were, they shouldn't want to have more than 30% possession in this game. But they came out, and I think maybe they were just so intent on putting on a show and maybe a little bit high on their own supply when it comes to, like, they were so good going forward against Belgium, but we could do it again, that they couldn't dial it back, but they needed to. And I was shocked, not that they came out on the front foot, but that after it was 1-0,
yeah,
and you get to the 10th minute, mm-hmm. Like, why are you even crossing midfield? Like, invite them forward. You know how to defend. You know how to make your CONCACAF, for God's sake. You know how to make teams miserable. And it's what got you here. And the weird thing to me was, I think we saw some of it. When they were dropping, they were going into that 3-4-2-1, right? It wasn't just a straight, flat 4-4-2 block, right? There were signs that they were just, like, maybe a little bit confused about what their shape was supposed to be when they got back. And because of that, Luka Modric and the entire midfield, which is so good, they started finding more time and finding more runners. And no team in the world can handle Croatia when Modric is out there dictating everything and finding runners.
There was a moment that I think was about the 12th minute when I said to myself, oh crap, here it comes. And it was Luka Modric got the ball at about midfield, and he was facing his own goal, and he actually had a defender on his back. And do you guys remember this moment next?
He put the defender in jail. He just kept the defender on his hip for like 40 yards.
But then what he did is he flicked with the outside of his right foot to an on-rushing attacker off the shoulder of the Canadian defender. And it's like, all right, good for you, Canada. Get pressure on the ball. Squeeze forward. Go man-to-man. You do everything right in that situation. And then the best midfielder of his generation just picks up his head, flicks the ball with his outside of foot, and splits you. And you think to yourself, oh, I've never seen this before, right? This doesn't happen to us usually in most games. We're just playing an opponent that can do it. And then from there, it just went downhill because Croatia became more comfortable with what Canada was doing. They became comfortable with the pressure and allowed their basic technique to take over in those moments.
They understood where the space was going to be. They understood that there was going to be space out there. There was going to be transition opportunities out there. And look, we talk about possession teams in Croatia. At their heart is a possession team, but there is no team in the world that turns down transition opportunities and running lanes if they're being offered up on a platter. And by about the 10th or 15th minute, yeah, the US do. Okay, that's fine. By about the 10th or 15th minute, Canada was offering that up on a platter. And that's where I bring it back to when we were talking free for life. John Herdman blew it today. Yeah, he did. He had to have, he had, like, what do you call it? Tactical periodization. Is that what basically what it means is, like, come the 15th minute, we're going to drop into a shell. We're going to change our shape, and we are going to change our line of confrontation. And we are going to change even our principles of play for how we want to get at that team. And it was especially necessary given that he started Atiba Hutchinson and Stephen Eustachio together in central midfield. Atiba is a legend. He is, he's holding the spot for Alphonso Davies, but as of now, he is the greatest men's soccer player that Canada has ever produced. His career speaks for itself. He cannot really move anymore. And you put him out there in a two next to Eustachio, who's fantastic. He would start for any team in CONCACAF and half the teams in Europe that are at this tournament right now. But Eustachio is not the type of midfielder who covers a ton of ground. So you're playing 2v3 versus Luka Modric and company. And the guys who are in front of you are Jonathan David, who is not really dropping in to help, and Alphonso Davies, who's kind of playing as a left midfielder, kind of as a left winger, but kind of as a central midfielder. And he's not really dropping in to help either. And you're just like, anytime there's a turnover, you're just scrambling. And it got ugly fast, and it ended up being like kind of lucky that it was only 4-1.
And I would say I agree with everything you said. And to me, the quick start and the aggression is let's get up 1-0. And so I understand. I do understand. Well, you score an early goal. The lesson is always you don't want to change everything. But the gimmick at the start was to get a 1-0 lead.
Yeah.
Like, it worked. And that's the frustration. And you talk about Croatia would know where the space is and they get comfortable. Canada also made themselves uncomfortable. They played multiple players out of position, quote unquote. I don't want to overdo that because they do have flexibility, a lot of these guys, right? Alistair Johnston can play as a fullback. He can play as a center back. That's fine. Richie playing on the left, that's fine at times. I think Alphonso Davies, over the course of this qualifying cycle, has struggled when John Herdman takes him out of position. And it's okay because he's still the best player on the field, but it doesn't help him a ton to be in positions he's never in, trying to press a center back, consistently trying to close passing lanes to center mids behind him and then press back. They're just not things he does ever. So you're asking him to do that as well. And then you add on two of the things Canada has accomplished over the course of the last 2 years is to protect center backs that aren't great. And that's Steven Vitoria, who has been immense in what they've asked him to do, but not.
They weren't asking him to defend in the open field, man.
Exactly.
They were not ever asking him to do that during qualifying.
And protect Steven Eustachio so that he could be the best passer on the field. And those two things, they went away from today against the best opponent they've played ever in John Herdman's tenure. And I think, let me finish with this and then Bobby, you take over. I know John Herdman blew it. It's part of the good and bad you're going to take. He has gotten this team to believe they are better than who they have ever been. He has gotten them to a point they've never gotten to. He has dealt with a lot outside the field to help them get there. He has flaws and he has strengths, similar to Steven Eustachio, similar to Alphonso Davies. Like, that's the nature of not being Brazil all the time, is like everyone who's great at something is going to have flaws. It's John Herdman's job if he wants it after this. I have no doubt in my mind. I don't know if he will. But I just would say, leaving that, yeah, these were some of the bad things that happened. And we saw it with the women's team as well in 2015. But they're only there because of a lot of what he accomplished.
I just want to magnify again what you just said, David, because this is what felt really important to me to add, is to keep this moment in perspective. Because, Matt, I don't think you're wrong that in hindsight, the approach was not right. And yet it is important to remember that Canada was always the underdog in this game. It would have taken an immense effort for them to have gotten a result out of this. And we have applauded other countries, other coaches, for taking outside the box approaches to what they were doing. I think if the US had lost on a goal, you know, a late goal to England, we would have looked back and said, why did Greg Berhalter go a man down in midfield? They got the result. It worked out. So in general, I am definitely okay with going outside the box. It didn't work in this. Herdman didn't adjust around the 20th minute early enough. But I do just want to put into perspective that it was always an uphill battle. And I am okay with the fact that he tried something new to catch Croatia off guard.
There was a few moments in this game, too, where timing just hurts. if this game had been 8 months ago or a year ago, I think Marc-Anthony Kay either starts or plays, and he was playing at a high level in center mid as a two-way player, and he just isn't that player right now. And Sam Piette, I'm surprised he didn't trust him because he has in the past, and he has his deficiencies, but you would have thought you put him behind even Atiba once Eustaquio goes off and let him at least pass a little rather than chase. And there was a lot of times where it felt like Herdman was going to bail out of this, and he never really did.
So looking forward with this team, because it is important to note that this is a start and definitely not a finish, right? Especially with 2026 World Cup coming and games being played in Canada. So where does this Canadian men's national team go from here? And what should we keep an eye on over the next 1 year, 2 years, 4 years?
So I think the next year, there's a few interesting things to look at. A big one is going to be dual nationals. Can you take the momentum of being on the world stage and Alphonso Davies and Jonathan David and Tejan being guys that people want to play with and go and win some of those battles earlier than you ever have before? It's going to be tough because I think outside of Nations League, you can't really cap tie guys. But we know the talk around Jebison. We know Luca Colioscio. We know some of these other players. Canada's a player now that they've never been before. Part of that is because of the environment Herdman built, that it feels more secure to go into this group. And the CSA still has its issues, so that hasn't gone away. But also because of the same reason the U.S. was able to convince Yunus Musa and Serginho Dest to join them. Because Tyler Adams and Weston McKennie and Christian Pulisic are your recruiters now. It's not just the guys in the Federation showing up to a club and trying to meet a young person. So I think for Canada, that has to, and that's not a negative, by the way. I don't want that to be like youth development's not strong enough. A lot of these players are developed through Canada, and a lot of players in the past have not played for Canada because it was just such a mess and it seems so hopeless. So I think Canada has to be intent on pulling a lot of players in now when they don't have meaningful games and they can get guys on the field and get guys in a camp. I think for fans, you're going to start to see Canada play good teams. Amy Walsh said this to us on the broadcast. They can get friendlies against good teams because it was a waste of time. And they'd have to take the money from Bahrain or from some other team to go and play them in, you know, a random place on a random friendly date. And now I think you're at a time where Canada can start to line up some really difficult games and get themselves ready for what will be coming in 4 years, as well as trying to compete in Nations League. So I think those are two of the big picture things that fans should watch for.
I'm going to name one more. Center backs. And this is true of every country in the world other than France. It's like nobody has enough good young center backs. I'm being more granular about this thing than David is, but I have confidence that Ismaël Koné is going to develop and fill Atiba's shoes. I think Eustaquio will be around. Sam Piette will still be around in 4 years. I really like Rita Zoer from Montreal. Mm-hmm. Like he'll take
another dual national, by the way.
Yeah, that's true. A Moroccan dual national. He'll take Kone's minutes. I love Jaden Nelson as a central midfielder. I think, you know, he's like, I don't have concerns about the attack or the midfield or the fullbacks. I have concerns about the center backs, because if they're going to play a four, which I think they might eventually do, like Alistair Johnson, he's not a center back in a four, and Kamal Miller is good, but he's the only one under like age 35 who's playing at a high level among Canadian center backs. So they just somehow, some way, they got to hope that a couple of kids, whether it's coming out of USL or CSL or MLS, they have to hope that a couple of guys prove to be answers there.
Okay. A Moroccan dual international, you say? Wow. That works out great, because the next topic of the day is Morocco's 2-0 victory over Belgium. The second match we saw. And David, you've been talking about Morocco since the start. It was the other game in Group F today. Mm-hmm. It now puts Morocco in a solid position to make it out of the group. What was the main takeaway from this win over Belgium?
Similar to what I saw in the first game, Morocco is a team that believes in themselves man-to-man. But what Doyle talked about with the strategy against Croatia, and Morocco did it there and did it in this game, is they'll sit in the mid-block and sort of make you frustrated. But when they go and when they press, they get after you, they can win battles, and then they're monsters in the open field. They've got athleticism on both sidelines, both at winger as well as at fullback. And they make the game fairly chaotic, and they do so in front of what I'm now hearing from a lot of people, arguably the best atmosphere and crowd at the World Cup. So once they got up on Belgium in the second half, and there was a sequence of, you know, set plays, and then Belgium's turning the ball over out of the back and Quartaz making great saves, it just felt like everything came down on top of Belgium at the same time in that stadium, and Morocco continued to push and push with confidence. And I wouldn't say it's a moment of brilliance on the opening goal. I think it's a little bit fortunate, but it's that little bit of knowledge and risk that you have to be able to have to win at this level. And it's something we've talked about a lot with Canada. You know, I think Paulo Dacá said to me, like, Alfonso Davies should have taken a foul against Luka Modric early in this game to kill the first goal play, but you just don't know it yet sometimes. And the experienced teams know it. And this is where the example is. Morocco came in 2018 and they were a half step away, and they've built over the last 4 years through AFCON and through qualifying. And I think they've shown in these two games, the understanding of what the level takes and where they need to go. And it wasn't, Hakimi's the best player on this team and he wasn't good today, and they still beat Belgium.
I'm glad you brought up the yellow cards, because this is one of the things I took notes on. It looks like the one team in the tournament, and I'll look at their defensive midfielder, Amrabat, in the middle, who actually, I think, exemplifies this.
Amrabat.
Thank you. Who exemplifies this. But they look like the one team who is not scared to take a yellow card. Right. Every other player in the tournament, you can't blame a player for this, right? Because if you get your second and you're suspended, that's heartbreaking for you personally. But it's almost as if they specifically said, if we are more intense, if we get into our tackles, then we are going to have a competitive advantage. And I think they exemplify that through the middle of the field. They're talented out wide, and they make you grind for every inch in a way that I find pleasing to watch, because these tacklers who aren't smooth, they aren't particularly proficient on the ball, they just want to make life really hard for you. And I think we really saw that today.
Now, that's Pac-12 soccer, right? That, I mean, that's what you learned.
You learned that on the road at Oregon State, man.
Yeah, that.
Now, they'd be even better if they could play through central midfield. The amount of times they have to hit big switches from one wing to the other, and they can't play through centrally, or they can't play in and then get the ball back for 1-2s, it limits this team. But it may not matter, because if they go and get a win in this final game, they're moving on to the next round for the first time in their country's history. And that was the job. We came into this reminder. They fired Vahi Halilhodžić for the 18th time of a country doing this. Coming into the World Cup this year, they brought in a new coach. And at the press conference 2 months ago, they said the focus is AFCON 2024 and the 2026 World Cup. They didn't even mention this World Cup. So anything they accomplish here, probably already beating Belgium, which I don't know if you've seen the scenes in Belgium of Moroccan immigrants celebrating in the streets of Brussels. Like, this is a big deal game. This, I think, is a win. But if they get through the group, it's everything to them. And that sets the stage for, again, another country that's battling for dual nationals and trying to build up their program to sort of go for the next 4 years.
On the Belgium side, I'm struggling to feel energized about anything about them, just because it seems like they're struggling to be energized about themselves, right? So there's nothing tactically to talk about. There's nothing soccer-wise.
No, there is, because you could talk about what's going wrong too, right? Like, we praised Greg Berhalter the other day after both games for the U.S.'s rest defense, and this is the most tactical sicko stuff that we could possibly talk. But like, the shape of the U.S. national team when they're getting on the ball and going into spots on the field where it could be dangerous for them to lose the ball is very good. It's very, very tactically sound. It's well drilled. And the point of this is to make sure that when you get into those high leverage moments, that they don't become high leverage moments going in the other direction.
By high leverage, you mean you have a high percentage chance of scoring, but if you lose it, the other team also has a transition that could be a high percentage chance of scoring.
100% that. And the U.S. has been like really, really good at that through 180 minutes. Like I said, it's tactical sicko stuff. I'm a terrible person for even talking about this. Belgium's disastrous at it. They're disastrous at it, and they've been disastrous at it for like the last 4 big tournaments that they've been to, and they've gotten away with it for the most part. because they're so talented. But as Kevin De Bruyne said, they're too old now. The talent isn't quite there anymore. And what we saw today was a Moroccan team that was set up to take advantage of those moments where Belgium's rest defense was garbage. And they were just begging to get countered, and they were begging to give up high leverage moments going in the other direction. And it's something that it's why, for as great as this Belgian golden generation has been, it's why I think that you could point a finger at them and say, yeah, they've kind of underachieved. And it feels like it's going to come home to roost for good in this tournament, and that they're going to have to, you know, turn the page following this World Cup.
I think everything you said is right and smart. I do think you're giving them a little too much credit. And in my mind, it's a bit like when you work with a youth team and at some point you're just like, you know what? You guys aren't focused enough for me to even work with you today or coach you today, right? They need to get their intensity up first. But that's all we need to talk about Belgium and Group F, and we should move on to Group E.
All right, Group E. Spain sitting in first place on 4 points, plus 7 goal differential. Japan in second place on 3 points at 0 goal differential. Costa Rica in third place on 3 points at minus 6 goal differential. And Germany sitting in last place after match day 2 at 1 point and minus 1 goal differential. Bobby, let's start with the big one. Spain versus Germany. This is the game most people circled coming into the group stage. It's obviously two of the giants, two of the last 3 World Cup winners as well. What did you make of how this one played out?
I thought the game shaped out exactly as expected, right? Both teams with similar styles. Spain really had the advantage because they were willing to press a little higher, because they were willing to be more energetic. And then by the 75th minute, I'm thinking to myself, wow, Spain has really made a statement. They have made a pretty good Germany team look second best throughout this entire game so far, but then something shifted and Spain lost control. And the truth is, I don't really know what it was, because they were still passing the same. They were still trying to press the same. I thought they were energetic, and I'm not really sure what flipped for either side to change the momentum in the game.
So I have a thought on this. In the 55th minute, Spain brought in Morata, and he's a true center forward, right? And when they do that, they sacrifice control for penetration. And obviously it paid off. That goal he scored was fantastic. But when Spain is still one of the best teams in the world, whatever formation they play, whether it's a 4-6-0 or, you know, or the 4-3-3, however you want to call it, with a false nine. I think they're better when they have a true center forward out there. The sacrifice, though, is that they don't have quite as much control. And by not having quite as much control, it gives Germany a chance to get on the ball in more dangerous spots. And then at the 70th minute, they said, we're getting on the ball in more dangerous spots. Why don't we bring on a center forward of our own? And they did. And that guy, I think, changed the game. And then the other thing that changed the game was Jordi Alba came off. Baldi, the 18-year-old left back from Barcelona, came in. He's a really talented kid. He was out of his depth from the moment he stepped on foot on the field.
Doyle, who did Germany bring on to change the game?
Was it Füllkrug?
I just want to hear you try and say it, because I felt you avoid it. And I was like, Doyle's got to take a crack at this one.
I just should have known your answer would be bring on the center forward. I should have predicted that. I can't believe I even gave you the space to do it.
But it's true, right? Because the game got more open in one way. It then became more open going down the other direction. And when it's a little bit chaotic like that, get a guy who likes to get in front of the net and can put the ball in the goal.
I agree with you, Doyle. One of the things that kills me is I don't believe I've ever seen Spain play well with Koke on the field. He is just so antithesis to what they are. And it's one of those things where you're like, oh, if we could take his attributes and put it into the team, great. But it has never worked. And I get respecting him as a player and a person amongst the group. But you lose a quick short passing player, as you said, similar to the center forward, except he doesn't score goals and it doesn't help the team as much. All right. So
before you move us on, give us the Meg Ryan report on the quality of play.
She said it was she said when we watch other games, it feels like everyone scores by mistake. And here it feels like they're purposely creating goals, which I thought was bold in a goal in which Musiala's touch sets up the goal accidentally. But she also said the speed of play was clearly the highest we had seen.
Do you guys agree with that? Was this the best game of the tournament so far?
Well, best game is tough because I think entertainment.
I mean, just in terms of quality.
I think so, yeah. I think when you watch the international game, Spain feels like a different monster than most teams. And so to see them not play Costa Rica, tripping all over themselves, it feels like as good as you're going to get at this stage of the tournament.
Okay.
Let's talk Japan, Costa Rica.
Bobby avoided that one. He's a coward. Bobby, absolute coward.
Bobby hates soccer.
You would never make it in that Morocco central midfield, man. You saw.
Oh, my goodness. Oh. I'm holding everything I have to say because I know we need to move on. The way this show usually works is Doyle says something, I disagree. Rich Kaufman is in our comments, our producer, saying move on to the next category. I bite my tongue and Goss transitions us. So let's just do that right now. David, send us to the next game, please.
Well, this is a great opportunity for you. We're going to talk Japan versus Costa Rica, 1-0 win for Costa Rica. Bobby, what do you have to say about this game?
Okay, this is real and genuine. This is not a bit. This is not me yes-anding. But Matt, you were right about this game. Everything you said about Costa Rica was right. When I asked the question, what do they do differently? How do you come back to a 7-0 defeat? You said specifically, you do nothing. You do the same thing. Their pride will take over. They'll fight like hell and they'll find a way to get a result. And that's exactly what happened. You were right about it.
Yeah. We've seen this for 10 years from this group of Costa Ricans. Keylor Navas didn't have to be Keylor Navas until after the goal, after Kacer Fuller's Tim Wakefield knuckleballer to the upper 90. It's more interesting to talk about Japan after this one, because they're disappointing me. For 160 out of 180 minutes at this tournament, they have been boring and lacking ideas. And I expected better from them at this tournament.
Okay. Well, I feel like we moved on for Costa Rica a bit fast because they did beat Japan in this game. So credit to them. They did make some changes. It wasn't the exact same thing. Shout out to Kendall Waston for having a really good day. On Japan, as much as Doyle, everything he says is right all the time, I tried to spend time yesterday on this show talking about Japan's issue with wanting to rotate and how do you do it in between the biggest games and trying to look long-term at potentially trying to get to the fifth game for the first time in their nation's history. You guys didn't even listen to me.
I don't remember the segment
to the next topic.
I don't remember you talking about it.
And it was pretty much the exact thing that happened for Japan. They started last game. They made some heavy subs and improved heavily against Germany. They proceeded to rotate literally everyone involved in that for a new set of players who played poorly. And then they came out against Costa Rica. And let's be real. Japan wants to play against the ball for the most part. And Costa Rica doesn't allow you to do that. And that's an issue a lot of teams have when you play against a team that is somewhat similar to you. I think we saw it at moments in Uruguay, South Korea. I think we're going to see it even more as the tournament goes along. We might see it in Canada, Morocco as well. Japan handled it poorly. Moriyasu, I think, is going to be in a lot of trouble at the end of this tournament because it feels like the group might be done for them. Like, it feels like Costa Rica or Germany will be the one going through. It won't be Japan at this point, even if Spain doesn't start their best lineup, which they probably will. And I think that Japan will look back at this one and say that we took it too lightly. We made the mistake, and you're not a giant yet. You don't get the luxury to take teams lightly at this stage just because you beat Germany coming from behind one time. So that's my read on most of what we saw.
You know this game needed so, so badly? It needed a 20th minute sub. Like, if you're ever going to watch a game and scream at the television to do something, change something, like, this Japan team needed it so badly, because 20 minutes in, you're thinking to yourself, oh my God, like, it's going to happen again. The better team is going to look sluggish. They're going to sleepwalk their way through 75 minutes and the other team's going to score. And when you have five subs, I have no idea in a World Cup. I mean, I understand it at a club stage when you can lose a player for a season.
Yeah.
But in a World Cup, when you're playing for your country over 1 month, why you can't just take a player out in the 20th minute and say, sorry, man, like somebody had to be sacrificed. I'm sorry it was you. This game needed that so badly. And I'm still surprised and shocked that it hasn't happened yet in this tournament where a coach knows they need to make a change early on.
Bob Bradley did it in 2010. He only had three subs. And that game could have gone to extra.
Yeah,
that
actually, yeah.
So I get it and I agree exactly with you.
We are joined now by Allison McCann of the New York Times, who is in Qatar covering the tournament. She is usually on the women's reproductive rights beat for the Times, but she's also the highest rated player on the staff, having played at Stanford and then briefly in the professional league. Allison, how's it going?
Hi. Hi, Bobby. Thanks for having me. It's going well. I am tired, but I have survived a week in Qatar, so I'm doing good.
Yeah. When you said that you were tired, I assumed it was jet lag, but what are your days like? Like give us the overview.
Yeah, maybe it was a little bit of jet lag from the start, but now, all of the games sort of start later in the day. I think the earliest one is 1 PM local time. Obviously they've shifted, when it's cooler. So then 4 PM, 7 PM, 10 PM is the latest game. And usually the 10 PM is kind of like the headliner or the big game, or so it's sort of worked out like that. So I've done a lot of the 10 PMs, which finish, 12:31, and then you file a story and you get back on the media shuttle at 2 and you're back, in your bed like 3:30 or so. So it's just been, some very late nights.
And then you wind down and don't fall asleep for a couple hours, then you run it back and start your day mid-afternoon.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah, it's like I played in the game, and when you couldn't like fall asleep after for like a few hours. Yeah, that's how I feel.
Totally. But it feels like you can't help but feel that way when you look at what the Mexico-Argentina game was like yesterday.
Yeah, I've been to four. Yeah, I think that was my fourth game, and that was definitely the most exciting and just vibrant. I think, almost 90,000 fans and absolutely so loud. And Lucille, I couldn't even hear myself.
I want to hear about the actual games in the stadiums, but I do want to start at the basics because I feel like I've watched every game of this tournament and I don't actually know what the scene around it is like. So what are your accommodations? Where are you staying? What is the hotel?
Sure. We're staying in this area in downtown Doha that's called Mashrib. It's sort of their new downtown that I think was built a bit in anticipation of the World Cup. I mean, you have to remember they got the bid in 2010, so they've had the better part of 12 years to like just absolutely build things. So Mashrib is like all new. It's a lot of high rises and like beautiful malls. And when people ask, I feel like the closest thing I can describe is like a Las Vegas, but like a really nice Las Vegas, not like, the old strip of Vegas. It's all, so we're in, they're technically apartment buildings, but it feels like a hotel. Like you have a, like a check-in at the bottom and it's a big high rise. And they're probably like a 20-story building and I'm on the third floor. And all of these sort of big high rises in Mashrib seem to all be like Western media. Like we're in one and ESPN is in another. And I don't think that like Qataris live in downtown Mashrib, or maybe if they did, they have vacated the sort of downtown area because it's just like full FIFA zone.
Can you tell the difference from where they built for the tournament and what seems to actually be part of their everyday lives and culture?
Yeah, a bit. As you, the stadiums, there's 8 stadiums and they're kind of all spread out around Qatar. You have to remember that Qatar is about the size of Connecticut, and Doha is pretty much the only city. I think they've now made like where some of the other stadiums are like cities. Like when you go to tonight's game is like in Al Khor, which is like another city, but it's like a 45-minute bus ride. So like we probably wouldn't call it another city, but so they have sort of these little manufactured new cities like where the stadiums are. And on the way as you're driving, you'll usually see like these big villas and sort of what looks to me like more regular, really nice huge villas. And that's where I think Qataris live, sort of the outskirts of Doha.
I'm trying to do a fun fact and think of the capital of Connecticut, and I absolutely cannot.
Hartford?
Well, we're going to say yes. We're going to call it Hartford. So Doha is the Hartford of the country.
Yay.
And then how do you get, so you leave your hotel, how do people get from the accommodations to the games? So
they have a really wonderful metro system that I think is also very new and was built for the tournament. So all of the stadiums are like connected via metro. I think the one that's the furthest, albeit, is like metro and a bus. But most of the fans are going, I think, on metro, or like, I think the Qataris are driving at big parking lots. For the media, we're kind of on this whole separate circuit, which has been really interesting to navigate, in which you should usually take the media buses and shuttles because they sort of take you to the media entrance at the stadium. Whereas like the first day I was like, I'm not taking the media bus. Like I'm getting on the metro. Like I want to ride with the fans. But then you're like entered the stadium and like the fan entrance and the media one is like inevitably like 7 mile walk away, like on the back of the stadium. So after doing that a few days, I was just like, all right, I'll get on the media shuttle. So we have to like come to the media center, which is like at their convention center. And then we all take shuttles there. I mean, I think there's something like 15,000 journalists. So it's a pretty like, yeah, huge media operation of just like getting us all around.
Now I want to know, I have no idea what it is for other tournaments. Is that high? Is that low? we need to figure that out.
I think it's like on par, but the difference is that we're all in the same place, right? Like if we were in Brazil or Russia, we would all be in different cities and going to different games. So we are just all here in Doha, and there's the possibility that you could, I mean, if you're insane, you could go to 4 games a day, right? You would go from the 1 to the 4 to the 7 to the 10, and like that would have never been possible at any other World Cup. You would have at most seen 1 a day, and you would have been in, you know, so we're just like, there's just so many of us and we're on top of each other. And you're like, I feel like, especially week 1 group stage, everybody was like I was going to a game a day, and even that pace, I was like, this is not sustainable. I need to like, yeah, like watch one in my room. And like,
has there been an Anchorman moment where you and Rory Smith and Tariq walk out and you're like, oh, there's the Washington Post. And then there's ESPN.
I think I'm so like, like not in the scene that I'm just like, I don't know who anyone is. I'm like, this is, listen, I did 2 Women's World Cup. This is my first men's tournament. So I'm like, I don't even know what's going on. Like, is this normal? What's normal? Like, this is crazy. Like,
yeah, I want to compare it to those other World Cups, because I was actually with you in France for those games, and especially around the games, the fan contingents are very real. You get to the game and it's very clear who everyone is supporting for and where the fan sections are. What is the fan vibrancy like in Qatar right now? Is it when you walk out and you go to the bus, in my mind, it's probably nothing but fans, but how obvious are these fan groups and how loud are they around the areas?
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious. And I think it's pretty, everybody's in jerseys. And I think the Latin American contingent, like South and Central, seems by far the strongest or the loudest. I think what is interesting is because you were not allowed to enter Qatar unless you had a ticket to the tournament. I think that changes after the group stage. But so there's only a smaller amount of fans, whereas like, I don't know, maybe in other World Cups, I don't know, do fans travel just to like, I'm going to be in the city. It felt like a lot of people in France, like for instance, like where they watched it at bars and in cafes, and there was a fan culture separate from the stadium and ticket culture. And here it's like, the fans are only entering stadiums. So yeah, that has just been a little, like there isn't as much of a street vibe, I would say, has been sort of a criticism. It's like they have all these FIFA fan zones, but there's not really fans in them because the fans are at the games. If you're here, you have a ticket and you are going to a game.
Right.
And you're not in the like downtown fan zone where there's like, whatever. If that makes
sense. Cause the fan zone is where you're supposed to be able to get the alcohol, right? It's the only place in the country where you can get a Budweiser.
Yes. The fan zones have alcohol. Very limited hours, and the Western hotels, so like the Hilton and the Marriott, also have alcohol, also limited hours. So
I want to hear more about the fan groups, because it's something that David talks about often, about how when you're in the tournament, there's actually a very clear ranking order of who the biggest fan groups are. When you're watching on TV, you think everyone has a pretty big contingent. But that, you know, Argentina is clearly very big, and that Mexico is clearly very big. And because it's in Qatar, Tunisia and Saudi Arabia, is that the way it feels at this tournament, that you could create a top 5 of the countries with the biggest fan contingent?
I think so. Yeah. I think that slots like, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 would be the ones you said, Argentina, Mexico, Brazil. I think the surprising one is Saudi, who obviously they had a lot of fans for their first game. And then we did a big story in the Times yesterday. I'm just like, they obviously they're so close. So people flew over, drove over, like they had everyone in Qatar. They were Saudi, like there were Saudi flags everywhere. Like they've really obviously gotten super into the tournament, and they're a neighboring country and they're doing well. So they're like, the Saudis are on this new wave of like, yeah, we love the World Cup, which has been really fun. But yeah, I think the Mexico-Argentina was on another level of the games I've been to, of just, yeah, absolutely full. It felt pretty 50-50 on fans, but like not a single seat empty. Whereas even USA, England felt like there was, it was mixed and there were probably a little bit more England, but the South American teams, just those fans feel.
How is the stadium environment? Like you said, you've covered two Women's World Cups. You've been going to games your whole life. What is it like in the stadium?
It's great. I mean, they're all brand new and shiny clean and the bathrooms are perfect and everything is wonderful. I mean, they're like beautiful, beautiful stadiums. And I'm probably in a minority opinion, but the lack of alcohol in the stadiums is very nice in terms of just like, not they're not being disgusting and like a bazillion like drunk men like screaming. I've never been as afraid as I was at the Euro semifinal in England two summers ago, in which it was just like 90,000 British men in Wembley like absolutely blacked out. So I think it's tamer and it's calmer, but it's really nice. I mean, it's all just very like manufactured and it's hard. You know, these stadiums don't have history. And there's, as a journalist, I think we struggle with the like, like remember that goal that was scored here and like things that come with a storied like legacy of football in the country. But I think obviously Qatar is starting that now and we'll have that.
And then what is it like outside the games? When you get dinner, if you do want to get a drink with a colleague, is any of that an option or is it straight from the hotel to the bus to the stadium and vice versa?
Yeah, it's been pretty like on the media shuttle. We did cook like one dinner with colleagues in the apartment. There has not been getting a drink with colleagues vibe. I think because there are so many games and people are doing two to three a day, we're all pretty like spread out and chaotic. Like I barely see Rory and Tarek and they're on my floor. And like, yes, I've like seen them once or twice this week. So, yeah, it's not like when we were in France. Yeah. And it was like, you still felt like Paris and we would all like go to a cafe and like have a drink and then head to the game. It's, it feels for me a little more like I'm on the media junket and I'm like, and this is how I have to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I'll put you on the spot a little bit to know on the ground, are there any stories that we should be paying attention to that we wouldn't know if we weren't actually in the country?
Ooh, good question. No, I think like the things I'm always surprised, like the things that have been like such a big deal, especially in Western media, like i.e. the booze and I mean, mostly the booze, like that doesn't feel to be a big deal here, like for fans as well. I think the people that want to get beer are staying in the Hilton, staying in whatever, and they're just like drinking there and they just get on the train and go. I think the media really picked up on that because, you know, Qataris changed their mind at the last minute to like be like, never mind FIFA. So I think everybody was like, but like people don't really seem bothered by it here. I thought there would be more like anger or frustration on that. But I mean, like we said, you had to have a football ticket to enter this country. So I think these are the most like diehard of diehard fans here. And they just want to watch a lot of football. And if they could drink, that would be fine. But they're on this, you know, they're on like football endorphins and they're just so happy to be here anyway. So that hasn't felt a big deal. I mean, for me, like, I was pretty unsure of just, you know, there's no rules in Qatar for women in terms of like mandatory dress or mandatory hijab. You know, there was a lot of guidance for us that were coming to sort of dress more modestly and yeah, just kind of more for your own comfort as opposed to anything else. And I feel like that, I feel like I could be in like jean shorts and a sports bra running around and there's just such a massive influx of Westerners right now. So I think, yeah, Qataris have been super understanding and like just letting anything go, even though it's probably, it's not what it would be like normally for them, but I don't feel like they're upset or angry or they're just like, that's strange. And a lot of Westerners are here and they can, you know, wear short sleeves because it's the World Cup and like, we'll go back to how it is normally once everybody leaves. And I don't know if that's come across as much, if that makes sense.
No, it hasn't. And I should have explicitly asked what your experience is like as a female journalist there. So I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah. It's been great. Like, totally safe, totally wonderful. Like, everything is clean and sparkling and, like, just, it's, like, too nice. You know, that's, I would say, like, that's the edge. You're just, like, yeah. Like, I'm always, like, where are real people? Like, yeah. Where do real people live? Like you said, like, where is, like, you know, the hole in the wall, like, Qatari restaurant? And, like, I'm not finding those things because it's hard to know what is, like, Qatari culture and what is just, like, the Disneylandification of a World Cup in your tree. So, hopefully I got another week. Yeah. And I'm trying to, like, scout out so a little more like authentic experiences while I'm here.
Yeah. Well, nice. Well, I appreciate you coming on with us. I like when you pop into soccer every 2 years.
Me too.
So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
A little bit of news before we get into the rest of the show. A guy named Lionel Messi may be coming to play in Major League Soccer for Inter Miami. We will have a full episode of Extra Time coming out tomorrow on the Extra Time feed. So you can go listen to that. And I'm sure Andrew Wiebe will find a spot to bring up Messi for a second or two in that one.
Oh, you think he might be in the title of the show on YouTube?
That'll probably be David Stats, right?
When you pause, David, I thought you had incredible news that you were about to break to us. That's what I thought was happening there. And I was very excited to see what came next.
And what comes next is match previews for tomorrow that we can get through real quickly. We've got Group G as well as Group H coming up tomorrow. The opening game, 5 a.m. Eastern time. The final 5 a.m. match of the World Cup. I know in celebration of that, we are all going to get up and sort of get into a Zoom party and in our pajamas, and we're all going to talk about it and celebrate. It is Cameroon versus Serbia on FS1 and Telemundo. Bobby, this is the team, Cameroon, now the second time they're playing at 5 that you are so excited to watch. What are you thinking about as they go in after losing 1-0 in their opening game against Switzerland?
Well, we said coming into the tournament that Cameroon was a team with the biggest gap in quality from their attackers to their defenders, and that would make it fun. One of the problems with that in their first game is they did not find a way to get all of their attacking talent on the field. Specifically, they need to be able to get Aboubakar and Choupo-Moutang, their two center forwards, onto the field at the same time. Right? When you are Cameroon, you need to get your talent out there, and that'll be the big question on their side. And then for Serbia, it's just the urgency for 3 points. You lost to Brazil in the first game, which is fine. You know you have Switzerland in the last game. It'll take at least 4 points to get out, so you need to get 3 points against Cameroon. And how does that affect the way they play? Usually sitting, usually hitting on the break. What will their urgency for points do to their style and their mentality?
You, one of the categories we set coming into the World Cup that we're going to talk about as we get to the end of each round and cycle is, what's the big paradigm shift that's going to come out of this World Cup? I've seen more teams play with legitimately two forwards up top off of each other in the last 8 days than I've seen in the last 3 years across soccer. And it feels like maybe that fits the international game. I think it's also talent, but it feels like what Iran was able to accomplish, what Uruguay sort of did once Cavani came on, that Cameroon can do the same, which is just make life a terror for a backline, because they have to deal with those two guys all the time and always have an outlet when you win that ball back. The next game in this group, Brazil-Switzerland. That one, 11 a.m. Eastern time on Fox and Telemundo. Doyle, this is going to be the first time we see Brazil since we hear that Neymar at least will be out for the group stage. What is it that you're then going to watch to figure out if Brazil can still be one of the favorites without him?
I mean, it just... The replacement is going to be a big one, right? Like, is it going to be like for like? Are they going to put someone in the 10 role and just like let him go crazy, which is what Neymar has tended to do the past couple of years? Or is it going to be a little bit more structured? And, you know, we've seen them, like Chichi's trying to get like a positional play thing going, and it's kind of working. And if that happens, does it put more of the ball at Vinicius Jr.'s feet? Does Rafinha become more influential? Do we see a team that looks, I'm not sure of the right word, but like structured with the creativity coming from that structure, as opposed to structured but with the creativity coming from like the sole genius who wears the 10 and gets on the ball?
Does the team look better without Neymar than they did in the first game?
I can't wait to find out, Bobby.
It's impossible for you to say yes to. If you had said yes to that, you would have shriveled up and burned down.
And here is the fun part for all of us out there. Switzerland will play well because Brazil is good, and Switzerland will play up and they will play down to their competition. Yeah. Yeah. So there'll be a bit of a test in this game for Brazil, potentially their biggest one in this group stage. So that's going to be a lot of fun at 11 a.m. Eastern time. Let's finish up with Group H. Portugal sitting at the top of the group, 3 points, plus one goal differential. South Korea and Uruguay tied, each on 1 point. Behind them after their 0-0 draw, and then Ghana closing out the group on 0 points, minus one goal differential. The first game in this group tomorrow will be at 8 a.m. on FS1 and Telemundo. That one is South Korea versus Ghana. And Bobby, when I think back to that first South Korea game, they outplayed Uruguay. They had a ton of possession in the attacking half. They created some good half chances. It doesn't feel like they have an idea of who finishes that. And Son has to be a creator for good stretches of the game for them. And so it feels like for South Korea to be one of those tournaments, whoever puts the ball in the net will start the next game and get a shot until they fail. And they're looking for that first person to step up in this one.
Yeah. Does it feel similar to Ghana? Because I think coming out of the first set of games, we thought that the premier young player who outperformed their team was Ghana's Mohamed Kudus, who really controlled the game. You disagree with that?
No, I think he's so good, man. So yeah. Good.
I was going to say, how is this a thing you could disagree with? I thought he was really the standout performer who outperformed his own team at a young age. But he is the player that controls a game and creates the chances. And then it is a question of what happens next, right? Who can match his level? IU got the goal in the first game, not quite enough against Portugal. So I do think we see a similar question for both these teams, competent in the run of play, but who is the difference maker in the moment?
And there was not a Portugal goal that was scored in that game that didn't have a clear Ghana mistake that led to it, whether it is the tackle on the penalty or the turnovers on the other two. And so can they just keep enough of a clean structure to allow Kudus to shine and be enough to take them over the top? It'd be cool to see Inaki Williams get going as well offensively. And the final game of the day, maybe the best of the day, a lot of talent out there on the field tomorrow, 2 p.m. Eastern time, Portugal against Uruguay on Fox and Telemundo. Uruguay coming off a 0-0 draw for them, maybe a quiet start to the tournament. Bobby and Portugal struggling at times, but a 3-2 win. What is this matchup?
Before we get into the soccer part, have you guys watching games found yourselves cheering against anyone? Or do you have an antithetical team in this tournament for yourselves?
I cheer against European teams.
Yeah, me too.
I legitimately thought you were about to say I cheer against everyone. So you cheer against your people. So I find myself, and I hope it comes off in this show, as legitimately excited and cheerful about so much in this tournament. And Portugal is the first team where I'm like, nah, not these guys. You know, I mean, we could probably dissect pretty easily why that is. But I just found myself watching the first game with like, yeah, this is the team that I really am going to probably cheer against. Yeah. For a couple of reasons.
I won't miss them if they're gone.
Well, if it's going to happen, it has to be a loss in this game because Uruguay, one, they'll need the win to get back up in the group standings, but you'd be shocked if Portugal was able to get points out of this and not go through. For Uruguay, thought there were some interesting things going on. Over the last 5 years, when healthy, Edson Cavani has been a better player than Luis Suarez. No question about it. Luis Suarez is a legend, and he starts all the time for this team, and Cavani hasn't been healthy all the time, so that's fine. If he is half of what he looked like against South Korea off the bench, I don't know how him and Nunez are not the two starters in this game. And I would argue if you slide them in a little, because Nunez played out left, you could also get actual wingers on the field to whip in crosses for the two most physical and dangerous center forwards in this tournament. But I just get paid to talk about soccer on Twitter Spaces. I don't coach a team.
Let me get this straight. David Goss is suggesting that they bench Luis Suarez.
100%.
That's all I heard.
100%.
Okay, just making sure I got that summer.
There's no way I'm going to question that now that Nunez has become the player that he has for this team. So let's see if Diego Alonso is brave enough to do it. Let's see what happens in this one. We will be back right after that game at 5 p.m. Eastern.
Are there any other big name legendary attackers in this game who maybe should be benched for better younger players?
I can't
on either team.
No? Are you talking about players who have like competed at a high level at the club recently and play at a high level? No, you're not. Okay, no. Cool. So we will be back at 5 p.m. Eastern time tomorrow. to talk about all of these games, as well as to help preview Tuesday, which will be the first cycle of the final round of games. And one of the really nice things that's happened throughout the tournament is, with such a wild set of games, pretty much every group is going to come down to both games matter, and they'll be happening simultaneously, and the movement's going to be really fun, and we're going to be there to recap all of it with you at 5 p.m. Eastern time every single day. So thank you to the two of you. Thank you to Allison McCann for checking in with us from Qatar. If you're listening live on Twitter Spaces, go listen to the podcast as soon as it comes out in a little bit. Thank you to all of you out there, though, for listening and being with us. We have finished the second weekend of the World Cup, technically. I don't know if that's what you'd call it. And tomorrow, our final 5 a.m. game for all of us to wake up and enjoy together. It has been a special experience, a warm experience. Bobby, do you have a quote from Hans Bacca to close us out on?
As Hans Bacca once said, take Ronaldo off and put William Carvalho on.
Yes!
And with that, thank you all for listening, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.